Up 19 at 12,220, the NASDAQ up 10 at 22.89, and the S&P 500 8 higher at 13.35.
WILL programming is made possible by Campus Be Active Toys in downtown Monticello. For Valentine's, Be Active Toys has Stuff Your Own Teddy Bears. Each one can be as individual as the person it is given to and comes complete with a cradle and birth certificate.
I sing the brain electric on this moment of science. Last time we discussed Dr. Robert Bartolo, the 19th century physician who demonstrated that the human brain sends signals via electricity by putting wires into his housemaid's brain and causing her limbs to move. While Bartolo's callous usage of his housemaid as a guinea pig made him a medical outcast, there are modern situations where a more delicate form of direct electrical stimulation is a must, and they show us a great deal about how the brain operates. The situation arises, for example, when patients have brain tumors that must be surgically removed. In this case, the surgeon needs to know as much as possible about which parts of the brain near the tumor are still healthy and what functions they serve. Direct electrical stimulation allows for this, and although it's a more delicate affair than the experiment run by Dr. Bartolo, the principle is the same. When surgeons touch different regions of the brain with electrodes through which current is passing, they are able to activate various functions. What the patient experiences during these forced activations depends on the area that was touched. An area in the middle and front of the brain, called the motor cortex, for example, makes different muscles contract. Stimulation of the back of the brain produces sensations of light and color. Another area might bring a long-distant memory to mind, or place the patient abruptly into a dreamlike state. Although it's strange to think of ourselves this way, direct brain stimulation shows that, in one sense, your brain is an electrical machine, the most complex and intricate electrical device in the world. This moment of science comes from Indiana University. Today's program was prepared by William Oram with help from Joseph Steinmetz. I'm Don Glass.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Lincoln Square Village in Urbana, the same square with a new angle, now with shops, offices, activity, and dining facilities, including Pretty Nails and Mr. John's School of Cosmetology.
Let's take a look now at sports headlines. Steve Spagnuolo has pulled out of the running for the Washington Redskins head coaching job and will remain defensive coordinator for the Super Bowl champion New York Giants. Spagnuolo's agent says his heart is in New York City. The Illinois men play 14th-ranked Indiana at Assembly Hall tonight, and things aren't looking good for the Illini. Illinois is 0-5 versus ranked teams this season and hasn't defeated a top 25 school since a 51-43 home win over then 23rd-ranked Indiana in January of 2007. The Illini are 2-8 in Big Ten play, while the Hoosiers are 7-1. The women are also in Big Ten action tonight. They're coming off back-to-back wins against number 19 Ohio State and Michigan last week. The women are in Minnesota to take on the Golden Gophers. The Illini conference record 5-6, Minnesota 6-5. Tip-off in Minneapolis is 7 p.m. Tip-off in Champaign for the men, 8 o'clock tonight. The Chicago Bulls have lost 8 straight games against Golden State on the Warriors' home court. Tonight they'll try to end that streak and score their first victory in Oakland since January of 1998. Tonight is the fifth stop of Chicago's 6-game road trip, which wraps up Saturday against Utah. And the struggling Chicago Blackhawks, they are in Canada tonight, where they will face off against the Calgary Flames. That's sports. An internet group, which calls itself Anonymous, is planning a worldwide protest against the Church of Scientology this weekend. Anonymous accuses the organization of trying to limit free speech. NPR's Kim Masters has more.
The fight began a few weeks ago after someone posted a video of celebrity Scientologist Tom Cruise on the internet.
Being a Scientologist, when you drive past an accident, it's not like anyone else. as you drive past, you know you have to do something about it because you know you're the only one that can really help.
The Church of Scientology said the interview was taped for its members and was copyrighted. It asked YouTube and other websites to take it down. Members of Anonymous saw that as an attack on freedom of speech and responded with this video posted on January 28th.
We are at war with the Church of Scientology. Our sole target is the Church as a corporate entity. We vow to avoid any collateral damage to any member.
Anonymous is a shadowy group whose members seem to see themselves either as internet pranksters or as masked avengers. They kicked off the fight with cyber attacks that swamped some Scientology websites. Their next move will be lobbying for the revocation of Scientology's tax-exempt status. Sean Cook is a member of Anonymous and regional organizer for Southern California.
This is something new to Anonymous. This is like hardcore political activists.
Last week, a suspicious white powder was mailed to more than a dozen church locations, leading to evacuations and a police investigation. The powder turned out to be harmless. Cook says Anonymous didn't do it.
We have a campaign. I mean, it doesn't include this kind of tactic. I mean, some freelancer might have done it.
Mark Bunker is an outspoken critic of Scientology who has, unwittingly, become a revered voice to many members of Anonymous. They call him Wise Beard Man. In a YouTube video, Bunker warned Anonymous members to avoid destructive tactics.
These are just wrong. They're morally and legally, and it's going to tar the entire group of you if you push for these type of things.
Tori Christman was a Scientologist from 1969 until 2000. When she left the church, she became a critic. And while she, too, disapproves of illegal tactics, she says the support of a computer-savvy group like Anonymous is heartening to those who have left Scientology.
It feels like we've been out in this desert fighting this group one-on-one by ourselves. And all of a sudden, this huge army came up with not only tons of people, thousands of people, but better tools, right? And we didn't even ask them.
Several members of Anonymous say they had no previous connection to Scientology, but thanks to the skirmish over the cruise video, they have studied up on the group. They object to other church positions, such as requiring members to drop contact with anyone, including family members, who the church regards as hostile. And they point out that Scientology has long been accused of playing hardball with its adversaries. Bob Adams, vice president of the church, says Anonymous is a group of cyber criminals.
It's very reminiscent of days gone by and current days with the KKK, wearing masks, hiding, having secret meetings on the internet.
But members of Anonymous say this feels like a turning point. One says he never expected the group to focus this seriously on any issue. Now he believes the group is on the side of the angels. Kim Masters, NPR News.
Tiny, single-celled organisms could become the giants of energy production in the near future. Scientists are using bacteria to convert waste into hydrogen energy. Lisa Ann Pinkerton recently watched a vat of microbes turning wastewater into electricity.
More than 17 million gallons of grape juice is sitting in what amounts to be a huge refrigerator. It's Welch's grape juice ready to be bottled. About the size of a gymnasium, the cooler's covered with tile, and the juice is stored in big stainless steel tanks. Paul Zorzi is the plant manager. He says they have to regularly clean the tanks, and first they rinse them with water to clean out the remaining juice.
Juice would be typically be anywhere from 10 to 20% sugar, so what goes down the drain might be 0.3.
Since there's still a little bit of grape juice and sugar in that wastewater, it can still be used. Behind the plant, the faint smell of grape juice wafts from a bubbling tank of wastewater. It looks kind of like a purple jacuzzi. And in a nearby shed, Gannon University professor Rick Diz has built a pilot system to convert the sugar in that grape juice wastewater into electricity. With the help of the Ohio biotechnology firm Nanologix, he's coaxing millions of microorganisms to consume the sugar and produce hydrogen.
The sort of bacteria that produce hydrogen and actually other biofuels of one sort or another just love sugar. Just like for people, sugar is the easiest thing to digest for many organisms.
Diz says if you keep introducing the food, that sugar from the watered-down grape juice, the microbe population will double every 24 to 48 minutes. He's trying to keep the conditions just right to encourage hydrogen-producing microbes to grow, while at the same time discouraging methane-producing ones. They feed on hydrogen, and it can be a careful balancing act. When the microbes produce enough gas, the pressure trips a switch, and the hydrogen is pumped into a slender, high-pressure holding tank.
And so far, we've been quite successful. We are, in fact, producing hydrogen gas, and we have used that gas to run an engine that generated electricity for us on just a demonstration purpose.
As you can imagine, there are all sorts of industries that create waste sugar water, from fruit juices and sodas to candy makers. So there's lots of potential to generate hydrogen and then electricity from residual sugar and wastewater. But, Diz says, the Welch's system is the only one in the U.S. to successfully do this outside of a laboratory setting. The Welch's plant in Erie, Pennsylvania, spends about $1.5 million a year for electricity and wastewater treatment each. It hopes a large-scale project that Diz will build this spring can put a dent in those bills.
Welch's is certainly one of the first companies that we've heard of who's expressed a serious interest in producing hydrogen for microorganisms.
That's Patrick Surface at the National Hydrogen Association. He says developing renewable ways to generate hydrogen is ideal for a greener energy sector, but the methods have to be economically worth it.
And now the trick is to make the leap from the laboratory to real-world applications and using the hydrogen to actually produce real electricity or meet some kind of other energy need.
Surface says if Welch's makes good on its plans to build a large-scale bioreactor, it'll be a major step for renewable hydrogen and an example for the rest of the nation's over 200 beverage makers and bottlers. For the Environment Report, I'm Lisa Ann Pinkerton.
Some experts say water will be the oil of the next generation. As it becomes scarcer, prices are going to go up. For farmers, that's serious business. Kyle Norris recently spent time with some farmers who say they think about water constantly.
Ann Elder and Paul Bantle are farmers, and they're pretty hardcore about water. They keep a hollowed-out rock, it's like a natural bowl, next to their barn. And every morning they fill it with fresh water for the farm's smaller animals.
And this amazing thing, the cat comes and drinks, the chipmunks come and drink, the birds come and drink, and the bees all drink from the same stone.
These folks consider water to be a valuable resource. They use it to grow a variety of fruits and vegetables on their 11 and a half acres. The farm is a biodynamic farm, which means it's organic, but it kind of goes a few steps further. Ann Elder says biodynamic farming emphasizes healthy soil and how to make the soil benefit the most from water.
Healthy soil means that it's alive, it's active, it's not compressed but fluffy. It will have a lot of organic matter, which will make it more sponge-like rather than compacted, hard, tight soil. So when it does rain or when moisture just does come, fluffy soil can take that in, and it can just drain through, and the roots can absorb it.
They till an organic compost into the soil. It's made of manure, vegetable matter, hay, and straw. And as biodynamic farmers, they spread herbal teas on their fields. They do this to feed the plants and to fight off problems like fungus. Their farm is in southeastern Michigan, and they get plenty of rainstorms overhead. Paul Bantle says they try to take as much advantage from the rain as possible.
Rainwater is way better than any kind of water you're going to pull from the earth. Irrigation water is cold. When it comes from 65 feet down, it's cold, whereas rainwater is warm in the summer, obviously, and in the late spring and early fall.
The thing about cold water is that it shocks plants that have been sitting all day in the warm sun, and that's no good. When they need to water their fields, they pump water from a 65-foot well. Bantle says he thinks long and hard before using this water for irrigation. He does not want to dig down further to tap deeper aquifers, even if that means that the crops will go through a hard time.
It's an issue. I mean, it's a huge problem. So definitely, I try to be very conservative about pulling water for irrigation.
Basically, there are two main irrigation techniques typically used in farming. The first is called drip, or trickle irrigation, and that's what Bantle and Elder use. It's a slow, easy method that takes time for the water to soak deep into the soil. It's kind of like a light, slow rain. The other technique is overhead irrigation. Picture your garden hose on spray. With overhead irrigation, the water sprays all over. The downside is that it wastes water because it evaporates and runs off from the fields. Lyndon Kelly is an irrigation educator with Michigan State University and Purdue Extensions. He says drip irrigation is like a minivan, and overhead irrigation is like a school bus.
It's sort of like, you know, are you going to take three or four kids to the baseball game after school each day, well, then you're going to take the minivan. But if you're going to take, you know, 50 kids to the baseball game after school every day, then you're going to want a school bus.
So typically drip is used on smaller operations, and overhead is used on the larger ones. But Kelly says drip irrigation can be used on larger farms. It depends on how the roots of the plant take in water. Grape vineyards, tomato plants, and some other vegetables respond well to drip irrigation. The farm that Ann Elder and Paul Bantle run is a relatively small operation. They pay a lot of attention to their crops, and they water them accordingly. All that effort takes a lot of thought and labor.
It's almost like a holding back mentality. How can I let these plants do what they need to do until which time the rains will come?
Farmers are going to have to reevaluate the ways in which they use water. Some scientists believe climate change will make some places much drier, and a growing population is already putting heavier demands on the existing water sources. For the Environment Report, I'm Kyle Norris.
The Environment Report is a production of Michigan Radio. Support comes from the Joyce Foundation, the George Gund Foundation, and USDA's Cooperative Extension Service. Have something to say about the Environment Report? Send email to feedback@environmentreport.org.
Earth and sky.
The high places of icy Greenland set a new record in 2007 for snowmelt. Marco Tedesco is a research scientist at NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center. He said that at altitudes above 2,000 meters in Greenland, a little over a mile high, snow melted for up to 30 days longer than the 20-year average.
This is about 150% greater than the average.
Data from satellites indicated surface temperatures over the Greenland ice sheet were up to 4 to 6 degrees Celsius above average in 2007. And as Greenland melts, sea level continues to rise.
When snow melts, you have two major factors. The first thing is, of course, melting snow produces liquid water that can directly flow at low elevation into the sea, so contributing directly to sea level rise, or it can percolate through the ice sheet and eventually lubricating the ice bedrock interface and accelerating the speed of glaciers flowing into the sea.
What's more, as fresher, brighter snow melts away, older, darker snow lies exposed, absorbing more sunlight and getting even warmer.
The most important thing is that we need to continue monitoring not only the Greenland ice sheet, but the whole Arctic.
Our thanks today to NASA in celebration of the International Polar Year. I'm Jorge Salazar for Earth and Sky, a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
Support for today's broadcast comes from the Prairie Ensemble, presenting a concert of opera overtures, arias, duets, and more at 7:30 p.m. on Saturday, February 9th at Faith United Methodist Church in Champaign. Featured are bass baritone Ronald Headland, tenor Justin Vickers, and soprano Kay Welch. Information available at 355-9077 or at prairieensemble.org.
This is WILL Urbana, the broadcasting service of the College of Communications at the University of Illinois. Daniel Pounder's forecast for Illinois and Indiana tonight: in the north, cloudy with snow showers. Elsewhere, mostly cloudy with a few scattered flurries. Lows ranging from 15 in northwestern Illinois to 30 in the south. Tomorrow, north, cloudy with areas of light snow and flurries. In central sections, cloudy with some flurries, especially during the afternoon. And in the south tomorrow, mostly cloudy with some sprinkles and flurries, primarily during the afternoon. Highs ranging from 28 in northwestern Illinois to 52 in the far south. Tonight in Champaign-Urbana, cloudy with a few flurries, the low 26. Tomorrow, cloudy with some flurries possible during the afternoon, the high around 40. Tomorrow night, cloudy with snow showers, the low 26. And the outlook for Saturday, cloudy and windy, with occasional snow showers, the high on Saturday, 35. Up next here on AM 580 and online at will.illinois.edu, it's The World from PRI. I'm Celeste Quinn. Our technical director is Henry Frain. Stay with us now for The World.